All right, now we're going on with the nutritional diseases. And this obviously fits into a couple of categories, either too little nutrition, which certainly happens all over the world, more frequently in developing countries, isolated deficiencies, which actually are relatively rare because if a person doesn't have adequate food, it means they don't have a lot of nutrients. And then, of course, what we have here in this part of the world, at least more frequently, will be either too much nutrition or the wrong nutrition, poor nutrition, adequate calories and fat, but not the proper mix of things. The thing you want to keep in mind here is this, and that is that when someone has a nutritional deficiency, the real question is, how did they get to that fix? Is it really dietary related? Do they not have it in their diet? If it's not in the diet, is it because the practice is to polish up the rice, get rid of the chaff, and so you eat white rice instead of brown rice, and you don't have the nutrients are there, or you cook the daylights out of it and destroy all the water-soluble and oxidative nutrients, or you simply can't afford it, and so you're eating dog food instead of green leafy vegetables, and you become folic acid deficient. So the question there is, if it is dietary-related, what is going on? So we will find it out. Is an absorption problem? That's an important one right here. Absorption. People who have pancreatic and liver disease have problems, major problems absorbing fat-soluble vitamins. And I want you to understand that because that represents a sizable percentage of people, either alcoholics with liver disease, people with cystic fibrosis, old chronic pancreatitis, and so forth. Another factor, too, is utilization. How much are you utilizing? We have certainly known in the case of pregnancy, we want to increase vitamin intake because mom's eating for two, but this little rascal that's developing inside of her is really going to town. That kid and placenta both are growing at a rate much faster than any malignant tumor ever grows, I can tell you that. you need to meet needs, especially folic acid, for both mother and fetus. And so utilization is important. Other things would be while you're recovering from injury, post-surgical, and especially people who are on cancer chemotherapy, where we might have some things that are being interfered with in terms of the way the chemotherapy works. Okay. The first thing here would be protein, lack of protein. This kid right here is kind of swollen up. The eyes are swollen. Everything is. The belly's swollen. And this kid has kwashiorkor. This is a condition that occasionally is seen here in the United States. It's true protein deficiency. Somebody who's eating only corn mush or rice or something like that, developing baby. Kwashiorkor, by the way, means second child. It's a New Guinea word. And it means second child. And what happens is that if mother becomes pregnant with a second kid too early on, and this kid is now is going to be displaced from her breast, he's not going to be getting the breast milk. The new baby will be getting the breast milk, and this kid will go on to essentially some kind of a plant-based mush diet early on, and they will become deficient in protein and other things as well. But and this is the manifestation of the decrease here. Why do they develop the edema? Well, they develop the edema because they can't make albumin. Albumin is a protein, and if our liver doesn't have the building blocks to make it, well, then we can't make the albumin. Hair and changes color. Hair is quite thin and brittle, and very serious central nervous system problems will develop, which may never be corrected. There was a lot of brain growth, a tremendous amount of brain growth going on very early on. And we're sending out dendrites and axons and all this stuff is going on. And if we can't basically, you know, have that happen, obviously we're not making new neurons, but we are certainly making extensions of them. And that depends on diet and protein in particular. And so you can have basically poor brain development for that reason. Skin changes are what we would see with, again, changes in pigmentation. It's not so evident here, but you might see that. All right. Marasmus is basically just total starving. It's just decreased calories, probably decreased everything. This is a carving of somebody who is very emaciated and thin. It's a woman with a papoose on her back. It's variously looked upon as an example of either tuberculosis, which could look like this, or just basically starving. The stunting of growth, if this occurs in children, of course, and this is a combination of both protein and the works, but total calorie deficit. Serious muscle atrophy, but it's we've all seen pictures of people who are starving and what they look like, and that's what this is. Obesity is a problem worldwide, no question about that. There are plenty of obese people in third world countries, but it's certainly a bigger problem here because of the quality of our diet, to say nothing of the quantity of our diet. And a lot of things are impacted by this, and this diagram is showing that we actually wear out our joints much faster because of the amount of weight that we're carrying on them. This is showing advanced osteoarthritis here in the knee joint, other places as well, other weight-bearing joints, the hip. We can have gallstones and so forth. We also can have liver disease, so-called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. One of the things that happens is that obesity contributes to hypertension, and it does so by increasing the amount of fat that's there. Means we also increase the number of capillaries and blood vessels that are there. And it's a tremendous number of capillaries for every pound of fat. I don't know if this is actually true or not, but I was told it was 6 miles of capillaries for every pound of fat that we have, extra pound of fat. Well, those capillaries, that's the point at which we have the resistance in the system, and that's what is going to call on the heart to have to work harder to push the blood around. Well, insulin resistance, of course, in type 2 diabetes is a given. And that one I suspect you know quite a bit about. High serum lipids is a part of that as well. As a consequence, atherosclerosis. So there are a variety of things that are a consequence of obesity. And all the vascular kind of things that go along with the atherosclerosis, myocardial infarction, heart disease, heart failure, and stroke and so on. I don't know all the stuff that really contributes to us overeating. We do. I think we have more calories in our diet than just about anybody else, plus the fact that they are not really healthy calories. They're very fat rich and that sort of thing. But this is showing some of the central nervous system sort of controls on what's happening with food intake, appetite, whether we want to eat, whether we're going to store things or not. And the object is, when we were coming along and evolving, perhaps all mammals were like this, you know, we kind of ate, we didn't eat very often, and we had to basically store everything. When you got something, you would use some of it then, of course, but you would store it because you'd need it later, because it may be 3 days before you got another meal, as opposed to 3 hours. As a consequence, we have a pretty good system of trying to store in the most efficient manner, trying to store stuff such as converting sugars into fat, putting it into fat cells, things of that kind. This is showing some of the things that are involved when things start to get out of whack that are more involved, such as ghrelin, things that are potentiators of insulin, leptin, which may inhibit the central nervous system in terms of anabolic cycle and wanting to take stuff in. At any rate, this is a very interesting topic, looking at how can we potentially interfere with this system. Could you create a pill that behaves like leptin or ghrelin or something that, and we can, by the way, that might inhibit your desire to eat so much. So it is possible that something like that will come along, and short of actually showing some restraint, which I'll be honest with you, I sure as heck don't, Well, all right, so obesity is an issue. Let's take a look here at specific vitamin deficiencies. And again, the real question that arises will be, how did the person become vitamin deficient? In the case of fat-soluble vitamins, it is often because of liver disease or pancreatic disease, which means they're going to be deficient probably in all four of the fat-soluble, K, A, D, and E. Water-soluble vitamins, generally when we have an issue here, we're taking a look at something that is really in the diet, that's lacking in the diet. B-complex and C, things that we tend to absorb and then either use or pee them out. So normally it's a dietary absence. On occasion it could be an issue with, say, like SPRU, gluten enteropathy, the sort of thing where we would see an inflamed bowel wall and we couldn't absorb them. But fat-soluble vitamins do require the capacity to absorb fat, and that is a function of their pancreas and liver working together and putting stuff out into our GI tract that allows that stuff to come in. And if we can't do that, then we're not going to be able to absorb these vitamins here, K, A, D, and E. So keep that in mind. Okay, vitamin A. This is an interesting one because of so many things that we now know that vitamin A is involved with. In terms of vision, yes, it's important for, you know, the visual pigments, visual purple or whatever we're calling it now. But it's involved in immune response. It's involved in bone growth. It's involved in epithelial maturation. There are many things that vitamin A is involved with that we never really guessed and didn't know much about until recently. So this is just showing the beta carotene and what goes on in terms of its absorption and modification that are involved in growth and regulation and differentiation of cells down here, visual pigments over here. Of course, we store it. We have a fairly sizable store of vitamin A in our liver, but it wouldn't last forever. It'd last maybe a year or so. thinking about ocular changes, these are things that are eminently visible, and I do want you to know about those. One of the things that will happen is that people will develop the normal conjunctiva, the very thin covering here over the eye as a whole, is composed of stratified non-keratinized squamous epithelium, and it's just a very few layers of that epithelium. And what happens in the absence of vitamin A is that the cells get confused in terms of their differentiation, and they start differentiating into keratinized squamous epithelium, and they get to be very thick. And we'll see what's called a Betos spot, which is a patch of, typically it looks kind of white and pearly, and it can be anywhere. It's obviously, it may be not easy to see out there on the sclera, but it's a patch of this keratinized epithelium. And what that does is it really changes the oxygen diffusion capabilities to get that oxygen into the cornea. Remember, that's how it gets there. We don't have a vascularized cornea. And what will lead to is corneal softening, keratomalacia, and even corneal ulceration, basically because of the thickening of that epithelium and the transformation of it, the metaplasia of it, to the keratinized form. Well, that occurs in actually a lot of organs, and what we will see is a transformation from, say, a columnar epithelium or a cuboidal epithelium. In other parts, such as in the respiratory tree, where it would normally be something like this, to a squamous epithelium. In the case of the kidney, where it's transitional epithelium, we would see it transforming into squamous epithelium and beginning to shed squamous, keratinized squamous epithelium, which might actually form globules and almost like stones, keratin debris and stones. So that change is going on in many other parts of the body, not just in the eye, but clearly in the eye, it's pretty visible. Let's take a look at some examples. Here is a Betos spot, this big white area right here. And these do certainly regress when we get the person on vitamin A. This is showing the very softened and basically rotten cornea. That I don't know what's going to happen with. This is a microscopic section showing the changes. Here is a very thickened epidermis or epithelial covering with keratin. Hopefully the hiccups are bad. Okay, I'm going to see if this continues. If so, I'm going to then stop this, see if I can get rid of these hiccups, and I'm going to stop right now. We'll come back to this picture once I get rid of these damned hiccups. Okay, back here again. And so here's our epithelial changes would be a conjunctiva, and you can see how thick it has become, the epithelial, how many layers of cells there are, and the keratin covering on the top. This shows a rat that was subject to that. You can see how his eyes have changed with the crud particular here. And you can treat it and reverse that. Night blindness. Obviously, the business with the visual pigments. All right, vitamin D. Vitamin D is an interesting one. And once again, we're learning a lot about it now. We've really known about in the past had to do with calcium metabolism and, as a consequence, bone growth. But now we know there's quite a bit more involved in terms of, again, possibly tumor suppression or at least maintenance of some aspect of tumor recognition or something, and even cardiovascular disease prevention. So vitamin D does a fair bit more that we're just sort of unraveling. Vitamin D we take in the provitamin form, and it has to be modified in the kidney. It's a two-step process, two hydroxylation steps. So people who have kidney disease will not be able to do that. The other step occurs in the skin, and it's a solar, basically. And one of the reasons, and the principal reason, I'm sure, that people in Europe and so forth lost their pigmentation is that we have problems with vitamin D, inability to make it. We all came from Africa. We were all black-skinned. All of our ancestors, remote ancestors, were African in origin, and they were dark-skinned. They were tall. And when people left Europe and moved into northern climates, and the dark skin in Africa, of course, was a protection, a UV protection, and probably to some extent water, I don't know what else, but certainly UV protection. But when they moved into Europe and began to roam around the globe, you could not make it. I didn't have enough solar, not enough sunlight throughout the year in order to be able to make vitamin D. So we lost our pigmentation, and that's actually the reason. So it's a two-step process. We take in the provitamin form. It's involved in calcium absorption from the GI tract when it's in its final form. The vitamin D is involved in calcium absorption in our GI tract and also recovery in the urine. And without it, we can't recover it in the urine or absorb it in the GI tract. And we have decreased serum calciums. And as a consequence, bone growth goes on, but there's no way to adequately ossify the bone. So we end up with very soft bones as an adult or very misshapen bones as children. Here's an example of rickets. You can see how bowed the legs are. It's uncommon to see that today, but it does still happen. Other parts of the world more so, I suppose. This comes from fish oils and things of that sort. But at any rate, people who are adults and have already grown to their full stature and have that happen and then lose the ability to either absorb or to, for renal disease purposes, can't modify the provitamin. They just develop very soft bones as the remodeling goes on, and they have problems with fractures. Rickets is the term we use in children, although it's exactly the same process. Because of the softer bones, the weight-bearing bones will certainly bow like you see here. That's rickets. Osteomalacia, that just means softening. The malacia is a softening of the bones. In adults, we use that term there. It's the same process again. But basically the epiphyses have closed and the person's long bones are their full length. But what they do now is they'll, because they're soft and weak, they break easily. Now, problems with vitamin D, this is one, all of these you can have too much. I didn't mention it in the case of vitamin A, but you can have too much vitamin A and get sick as a dog and have increased cerebral spinal fluid pressure, pounding headaches, all kinds of issues from that. In the case of excess vitamin D, people think, well, if one pill is great, two must be fine, must be even better still, and five must be really great. And so people who take lots of vitamins, in fact, have problems related to it. In the case of vitamin D, you can just keep on cranking it out and you end up hyperabsorbing calcium, and then you have you clear a lot in the urine and you end up with kidney stones. So too much of any of these vitamins is going to be bad for you as well. Vitamin K, still dealing with fat soluble vitamins, vitamin K is involved with formation of four of the clotting proteins in the liver. And this is a post-translational event that takes place with vitamin K. And here we're taking a look at a hemorrhage on the surface of the brain that occurred in somebody who had absent vitamin K. So these are, and in fact, we interfere with vitamin K when people take a blood thinner like warfarin. What we're doing is we're interfering with the ability of the liver to utilize vitamin K. It's how rat poison works, one of the rat poisons. K, A, D, and E. I can't tell you very much about E. It's an important antioxidant. It's an important lipid-soluble antioxidant. But what else it does, I don't know. It may do quite a bit, but I don't know about it. Okay, we're going to move on to water-soluble vitamins now. And it's a B-complex, as it's called. Kind of an interesting way in which the vitamins got their names, and we've carried this forward all this time. Back in the early 1900s, it was recognized that there were elements in our diet that were either there were nutrients that were required for metabolism, cellular metabolism, some kind of a coenzyme, something like that. And after they got looking around at it, the discovery was that there was a fat-soluble vitamin, which was vitamin A, and there was a water-soluble vitamin, which was vitamin B. And that was kind of the whole story. And eventually there was another fat-soluble vitamin C. Well, there were a variety of things that came in that started to grow up later that were similar to the initial vitamin B here. And so they began referring to them as B1, B2, B12, B6, and beyond, you know, on and on. But initially they thought, well, there was only two vitamins, you know, vitamin A and vitamin B, and there we go. Vitamin B is, again, it's a complex of things, and I'm not sure when we're going to talk about B1 here, but it may well be that in our diet that there's a B1 prime and a B1 double prime and things like that that we don't know about, which also have effects that, you know, change cellular metabolism just a little bit, sort of fine-tuning it. The B group as a whole, these are all water-soluble. We tend to get them from green leafy vegetables. Since they are water-soluble, they're freely absorbed, but that means they're also freely lost in the urine. And so we have to have pretty much a daily amount of these things. There isn't something that we can particularly store. Unlike some of the fat-soluble vitamins, where we do have a storage of it. Cereals, deficiency states, where do we see it? again, would be, poor nutrition, absent nutrition, either highly refined foods, and people, alcoholics, who just simply don't have it in their diet because their diet consists largely of booze. And the idea of a salad or something like that is just really not on the radar screen. B1 deficiency has two forms. There is a variety of this that we see pretty much in the Orient. We can see it here, called beriberi, and it has actually two clinical manifestations. One is heart weakness that leads to heart failure, and the other is problem of maintenance of the Schwann cells on the peripheral nerves, so people have peripheral neuropathies. And what is being shown here in the A and the B One is the heart failure. The other is a foot drop, because these people have damage to the Schwann cells, and they can't maintain that axon, the health of the axon, from the motor neuron on down. What we see here in the United States is what's depicted in C, and that is the Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. I'll say a little bit about that. And that has very significant central nervous system effects, and it's definitely related to alcoholism and what I think would be probably a combined vitamin B1 deficiency and alcohol. So in the case of what we see, that the central nervous system component, as opposed to the beriberi, which is the heart failure and peripheral nerve issue, what we see here in the United States is referred to as Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. I have never encountered it outside of someone who's an alcoholic. They have poor nutrition, and what will happen is they actually have some damage to the brain, which involves some of the extraocular muscles, some of the innervation of extraocular muscles, principally the third cranial nerve. And they'll have infarction and death of what's called the mammillary bodies here at the base of the brain, and third nerve problems. And so these people can have sort of fixed ocular gaze. They can't move their eyes, and it's pretty frightening for them. The Wernicke's encephalopathy refers to the actual physical findings. The physical abnormalities, I can't move my eyes, they're locked and I'm looking up and what am I going to do? And the hemorrhages that we see here in the mammillary bodies. The Korsakoff's thing is a psychiatric problem. Again, probably due to some kind of an actual defect, some sort of death of part of the brain. These people are very good at what's called confabulating. And what they do is they basically make up part of a story. If they're telling you what's going on, they can be overtly psychotic, but if they're talking to you about an event, and they may have episodes where they simply cannot remember anything about that event, maybe a little portion of it, they'll come to that and they'll just simply make up something that seems pretty reasonable. Now, you may not even know it if they're just telling you and there's nobody else there, but if there's someone there who was also with them, it's pretty interesting to see what they look like, because they'll look at this person like, what the heck are you talking about? You know, that's not what happened, but this person will just sort of fill in the gap as if that is perfectly appropriate. All right, so Wernicke's is the encephalopathy part, the damage to the brain. The Korsakoff's is a psychiatric part of this. Here's another vitamin of this category, niacin. Probably has a B designation. Condition we see with deficiency of this is called pellagra. And pellagra has three D's to it, dermatitis, diarrhea, and dementia. And it has to do with the niacin, as you probably know, is sort of the guts of NADH and ADP, that sort of thing, NAD and NADP. So we're looking at electron transport. Well, we're looking at electron transport. We're looking at something there that's involved in cellular metabolism. And what's demonstrated here is a rash that we see. The dermatitis part of this that we see in sun-exposed areas. So we'll see it on the person's face, their hands and their feet, if their feet are exposed to the sun. This was present in Native Americans. When Columbus arrived, people were drawing pictures of Native Americans, and some of them demonstrated these changes. The thing is that people in Central America, at least in large population areas, basically had a corn-based diet. And corn is notoriously deficient in both niacin as well as tyrosine. The amino acid tyrosine, we can make our own niacin from tyrosine internally, but if you don't have either of them, you're going to be in a world of hurt. And so what we're looking at here is the epithelial changes. The epithelium is very thin. You get a bad sunburn, the epithelium sheds, and that's the reason for the diarrhea. People will have epithelial changes in the gut, they'll lose the epithelium and so forth. And precisely the reason for the dementia, I can't tell you. We also can see it in people who have a large amount of alcohol in their diet, which means they probably don't have much of anything else in their diet. So we might see a vitamin D deficiency, or not D, but a niacin deficiency here in one of the, in someone of that sort. Vitamin C does a lot of stuff for us. This is our principal water-soluble antioxidant, and clearly it's involved in production of collagen. Depending on, and also helps us absorb certain metals, because what it does is it changes the valence state of the metal in our GI tract. So if someone has, say, iron deficiency anemia, we don't want to just put them on iron alone. We're going to put them on iron and vitamin C at exactly the same time. So they take the pills at the same time. And what it's going to do is it's going to render the metal, whether it's iron or copper, into its reduced form. Remember, these are ones that can either have F plus 2, F plus 3, cupric, cupress. What we're doing there is getting it into a state that enhances absorption. But in terms of collagen synthesis, it's involved in hydroxyproline, hydroxylation of the lysine and proline to make our collagen. And when we don't have that, the collagen is very weak. It's not assembled properly. And people develop what's known as scurvy, which is life-threatening. You will bleed to death with scurvy because the vessels, the little vessels, all rupture and tear apart and fall apart. And scurvy was a real issue for explorers here, European explorers, and because for the long winters and so forth in Canada and so forth, they didn't have the citrus and veggies. Tomato is an important source of it, by the way. Onions are too. But they just simply didn't have that in their diet. Native Americans did have a solution. They made a tea that they drank out of pine needles and bark and stuff like that, and they extracted the vitamin that way. So they have basically showed the Europeans what you can do to prevent scurvy. Here's the issue with that is the weak connective tissue. We're constantly remodeling and working our connective tissue. And so if the destructive forces aren't aware of the fact, and they won't be, they're not aware of the fact that the building forces are not working like they should. They go right on tearing down the old collagen, but we're not building it back up. So we have poor wound healing. If you do have an incised wound, such as you show over here, the teeth, which are held in place by collagen bundles and so forth, they get weak and fall out. We have joint hemorrhages, lots of skin hemorrhages and things like that. And this is showing overgrowth of cartilage, for one thing, but also showing lots of petechial hemorrhages here, bleeding into the skin because of weak connective tissue around the blood vessels. A very painful thing is when the covering over the bone, the periosteum separates and it bleeds into there. It's like having a terrible fracture, and you can see that right through here in that x-ray. So vitamin C is involved. Without the collagen, without that new collagen, we have a lot of problems related to bone growth and connective tissue and so on. Okay, let's see where we are here.